the problem that health workers themselves, as well as hospitals and patients, are under attack is one of the most under-recognized problems, both in public health and human rights. It's quite remarkable. But in the last couple of years, there have been a lot of important developments. And I want to talk to you about those developments and what we can do. This title slide shows pictures of doctors and nurses in Bahrain who were arrested, tortured, and prosecuted, essentially for providing care during the uprising at the beginning of the Arab Spring. And just in the last couple of years, it's hardly the only example. The most spectacular, probably the worst place in the history of documenting these abuses has been in Syria, where more than 57% of the hospitals have been damaged, 36% not functioning, based on government shelling from the ground and the air. And patients have been tortured in hospitals if they're deemed to be part of the opposition, and more than 130 doctors have been killed, and now we're way over 500 who have been imprisoned. But Syria isn't the only place. You have heard, I'm sure, about polio workers under attack. In the last year alone, 29 polio vaccinators have been killed in Nigeria and Pakistan. The map at the bottom from the BBC shows the varying places where that's happened in Pakistan, not all of which are war zones. And in a very different and unknown conflict in eastern Burma, which has gone on for 50 years, the Burmese government does not provide, or until some peace agreements in the last couple of years, they didn't provide health care to the ethnic provinces in eastern Burma, and the local health workers who were trying to provide care were harassed, clinics were burned, their supplies were taken, they were kidnapped. And, of course, that pervasive insecurity had this effect of denying health care to the indigenous population. Most recently, excluding Syria, in Turkey, which we don't think of and is not a country at war as well, during the demonstrations in July, doctors and nurses were arrested, tortured, and jailed for crimes against the state, essentially for treating wounded people. Hospitals were tear gassed. And a proposed law now would... would allow emergency medical care only if authorized by the government. Whoever heard of that? It's the opposite of the Good Samaritan laws, that we're going to prohibit you from providing care to people we don't like. And for the first time ever, we have a kind of a global picture, although the data isn't terrific. The International Committee of the Red Cross conducted two studies in 2011 and 12. The most recent in 22 countries found almost 1,000 incidents. And this is something that is really unknown. The humanitarian community, which does fantastic work, but it's the only community that people have paid attention to in terms of attacks. Yet 90% of the health workers who were victims were from local providers. And in many cases, that's even less documented, and this study shows how inadequate the documentation is, the insecurity itself prevents people from getting access to health care. And we know these impacts go way beyond the kind of data that's in the ICRC study, because when a hospital is destroyed, it's not just the nurses and patients and doctors who are hurt, but the access to care in the future. And we have very little information about this. This has not been a phenomenon that's studied. And if there are students wanting to do cutting-edge research in this room, this is it. It's a virgin field. One of the few studies took place in Sri Lanka. The solid line is the northern province. And it shows what happened. The bottom line is the northern province, which was the conflict zone. What happened to physicians during a period of conflict? And you see that the deviation between the beginning and the end among health providers in the conflict role was dramatic. And the same, different lines, but same trends for midwives. Well, not surprisingly, when you look at this decline in health personnel, what happened to maternal mortality? It went up dramatically. And even though it declines, the conflict leveled off, you see at the top, that it never declined past a certain point. So we have these incredible effects. So what needs to be done? There are five things that need to be done, and I'm going to talk about the ones that are in red. But I want to mention the first one, that the International Committee of the Red Cross has started a very important campaign called the Healthcare in Danger Project, which is designed to develop more sophisticated prevention strategies and security strategies in the field, from how hospitals can have better security procedures to how ambulances can have better communications to how you negotiate with warring parties. And it's a very important initiative. But there are four other things I want to talk about. The first is strengthening norms. We have had strong norms from the laws of war, the Geneva Conventions, which basically have four dimensions: protecting healthcare personnel, patients, the wounded and sick, public health programs, and healthcare facilities. And they're all protected from harm and attack in times of war. But that problem with that is that humanitarian law, the law of war, is limited to situations of war. So those slides I showed you about Bahrain, about Turkey, those laws don't apply. So we have to look elsewhere, and that elsewhere has to be human rights law, but that has not been applied in the past. Beyond that, humanitarian law isn't terribly explicit, except in situations of occupation, what the affirmative obligations are to make healthcare available and accessible to the populations. And except for criminal prosecution as well, under as a war crime, there are no accountability and compliance mechanisms under the humanitarian law. So we need another source of law. And now we've got it. It's a really positive development. Literally a week or 2 weeks ago, Special Rapporteur on the Right to Health, who was appointed by the UN Human Rights Council, issued a very important report. It's available on the web, basically showing how human rights law applies in these situations, both in armed conflict and in situations where war is not taking place. And they parallel the Geneva Conventions in many respects. Don't attack or interfere with healthcare or punish health workers for providing care to disfavored groups, as has happened in Syria, Bahrain, and elsewhere. Prevent interference by third parties. For example, let's get some security for vaccinators. That's a state obligation in Pakistan and Nigeria, and it wasn't happening. And, of course, make sure healthcare is available in situations of insecurity. And it's no excuse. It really is no excuse that you may have other pressures during periods of volatility. You especially have obligations to vulnerable populations. So we have to move forward with these new norms. We've got the foundation with the report of the Special Rapporteur. We need the Human Rights Council to act so this official UN body can reinforce that these norms exist. We need to get the human rights machinery engaged, so we have field investigations by the Office of the High Commissioner in Geneva, which is the UN Human Rights Investigation Body. And we can reinforce through all these wonderful mechanisms I don't have time to talk about within the UN system, where governments have to report on their human rights record and be held accountable to them by civil society. Second thing we need to do, we need to know the facts. Susanna mentioned how rape is not well documented. Well, these events are even less well documented. We have all kind of data collection going on out there. I'm not going to spend time on this, but if you look at the last column, if we're going to have human rights accountability and put pressure on perpetrators, the information has to be public. Now, humanitarian groups have very good reasons not to publish their data. They are concerned about access. They're concerned about their own security. They don't want to make the data public. So as a result, there's not much public release of data, except in the academic world, but those are a handful of articles. And the ICRC's terrific report, as good as it was, I said it was 22 countries. It didn't even identify the countries. So we need a system to collect data toward human rights accountability. Well, we've made some progress. In 2012, the World Health Assembly, which governs the WHO, passed a resolution saying, you've got to do this, WHO. You are now responsible for making sure data is systematically collected on attacks on health in complex emergencies. And that process is ongoing. WHO will need some pressure to make sure they comply, but we've got the grounding. There are some other initiatives through the UN Security Council and through other UN entities. ICRC, I mentioned, is collecting data. Doctors Without Borders are starting to collect data. And we at Johns Hopkins are developing an incident reporting tool. So we have some hope that this can happen. The next prong, the third prong, I said I would talk about is accountability. There's been no accountability. There's been impunity for these attacks, by and large, for the last few decades, as long as we've been tracking it. Well, we now have the opportunity to make impunity go by the boards. 2 years ago, the UN Security Council passed a resolution, that's not the year, that's the number, 1998, which increased its monitoring and enforcement responsibilities with respect to attacks on children in war, but, and in this case, with a focus on schools and hospitals. And hospitals has been interpreted to mean all health facilities and personnel. So we have a mechanism there. We can talk about that later. We can now invoke the human rights machinery I mentioned a moment ago, including the process of what's called universal periodic review, where every country has to come up for review of its human rights record. Cases can still be referred to the International Criminal Court. You should all urge the United States government, if you're Americans, for example, to say to the U.S. government that it should fight for a resolution about Syria to refer war crimes, including attacks on health care, to the International Criminal Court. There can be action at the national and regional levels, and there can be diplomatic pressure. Finally, what we need is we need civil society mobilization. And happily there, too, there is a new coalition called Safeguarding Health in Conflict. And I don't think you can read the URL there, but it's safeguardinghealth.org. You can get involved. NGOs are involved. Individuals can sign up to get involved. There's little sheets at the back to get more information. But you see, we have this tremendous opportunity to deal with a problem that has been ignored for way too long. And the next 3 or 4 years are going to be critical in determining whether we develop the kind of mechanisms that can start ameliorating limiting the number of attacks and providing accountability for those who engage in them. So that's the end.